Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening to you all. This is the Business Day Spotlight, your destination for African business made simple. My name is Mudiyo Kabaza, and for today, we are going to be talking about the renewable energy sector, specifically, solar and solar projects, and, some of the work that's actually happening in the space, some of the impediments, and, possibly some of the solutions to actually make sure that, some of these things do get through. We are going to be talking to the team, from Solar for today, and just getting an understanding. They are, Solar Group, and we're going to be talking, to Chris Ho, who is from Solar Group, and just to get a sense, what's going on. He is a co-founder and executive director at Solar Group. Chris, greetings to you today.
Good afternoon, Madiwe. Thanks for having me on your show.
Let's begin with, before we dive into, some of the projects that are actually happening in the country, Solar Group. I noticed that, this is obviously not spelt the typical S-O-L-A-R. This is S-O-L-A, and it is capitalized. I'm not sure whether there's an acronym sitting behind there, but maybe you can give us a little bit of an understanding around, your group, your perspective when it comes to the renewable sector, and I guess your context, just so that we understand that before we get into the meat and potatoes of today.
Thank you. Yeah, that's correct. The name Solar Group it's not actually an acronym. It's just a short and simple name for our company because we focus on solar energy and battery storage. And so the company is a 100% South African owned company. It's locally grown here. I founded the company with my brother approximately 18 years ago now. So we've been operating from the very early days of the renewable industry in South Africa and have been involved in a wide range of different projects and procurement processes throughout that time period. Right now, solar has grown to be one of the largest IPPs in South Africa, and we have a portfolio of over 600 solar projects that are either in 600 megawatts of solar projects that are either in construction or operation. And that falls over also about 100 projects that we've constructed in various sizes. But that amounts to a capital investment of debt and equity that we've raised of around 10 billion rand, 75% of that, which is actually already spent in projects in the ground. So we are very active and we operate widely across the value chain of that particular technology. And so we employ engineers, we employ accountants, we employ project managers, we employ site technicians to deliver high quality solar projects in South Africa. And that's our expertise. We've been doing that for a long time. And we focus on that particular element of the renewable energy spectrum.
So maybe what we can do is to get into some of the practicalities around what's actually happening in the sector using a project that I believe that you've been involved in. That's with, Renogen. And I always look at this word Renogen, yes, to be like, is it Renogen or Re-Energen? And that's, they have a project that was recently disputed or, rejected by the Department of Mineral Resources, right? And I believe that would have been South Africa's single largest solar plant, had that project come to fruition. Couple of things, right? Firstly, size and scope of, something like this. And then secondly, for a company like yours, right, what's your involvement in something like that?
Yeah, thanks. So this particular project that you're referring to, it's not a project that we are doing with Renogen. Renogen just happened to be an independent company that unfortunately have taken some issue with the way we've gone about developing and constructing the projects. But the project is a 150 megawatt solar project. It's a bifacial tracking project. So the track is moved from east to west, and they generate the maximum amount of energy available from the sun at that particular location. And then it's connected onto the national grid through one of the substations, and it will export the power from the project onto the national grid, which is then sold to a number of different companies around South Africa. So the project solar's involvement in the project is right from the initial development phases of the project through to some of the permitting and licensing, the design of the project, the financing of the project, the construction of the project, and also the operation of the project, as well as the ownership. So we own the majority stake in the project, and with our other shareholders, we will operate that project for hopefully its foreseeable life of 30 years.
All right. So with the department having with the Department of Mineral Resources having rejected suspension application, I take it then that means that, you know, everything is moving forward, and that, you know, it's not stopping as had been, I guess, intended by Renergen when it made that application to the DMAR.
Yes, that's right. So the project is currently under construction. It's going very well. We're installing close to 4,000 panels per day. There are 400, between 400 and 500 people from the local area working on the site, installing panels and building the project. So it is underway. And I think it's important to remember and state that solar, when we develop our projects, we always approach such developments in a very thorough and consultative manner, making sure that we have all of the permits and licenses before we start the construction. As I mentioned, we've been doing this for almost 18 years now, and so we have built a lot of projects. We have a tried and tested formula for making sure the projects are constructed on time and on budget, as well as having all the permits and licenses in place. And that is also the case with this project. It has all the lawful approvals in place, which was confirmed by the DMRE in their response to this application from Renergen.
You know, one of the things I'm most curious about, Chris, is, you know, you guys have been in this arena for quite some time. Obviously, you know, things like solar have had a lot of ups and downs over the years. People get excited, but, you know, it's still a little bit expensive and, you know, out of reach for a lot of individuals and businesses. Then at some point, we reach a point of inflection, you know, where your cost of solar has come down to a point where it's a little bit more cost effective, you know, and a little bit more in reach, you know, for the normal person as well as businesses. And then obviously we have that acceleration, you know, around attention, at least on solar. I see a lot of contrasts, you know, between how solar has developed in the last maybe 2 to 3 years in South Africa with AI in the rest of the world, you know, technologies or, you know, that have been around for some time. But you have a moment in the sun and, you know, you now have a lot of attention, you know, on what's going on. And obviously load shedding was a big thing that got a lot of people thinking about and talking about solar. Not to say that it was, you know, something that was dormant or sleeping. You know, players like yourselves had, you know, been in the sector and developing projects for a long time. But one of the things that I'm curious about is a dispute such as, you know, Renergen and making that application. What does it tell us about, I guess, the state of play, you know, in the sector, and I guess some of the realities around putting down, you know, some of these projects and actually seeing them to fruition?
No, good question. I think You know, look, these projects are large scale infrastructure projects. So we, you know, we are working on some of the, these are some of the largest solar projects in the world by global context, by global standards. These are very large solar projects. And so, you know, the Springbok project, which we've been referring to now, I mean, that's a, an area of approximately 400 hectares of solar panels that are being covered. And so, when you approach these kind of large-scale infrastructure projects, there are lots of steps that you have to go through in making sure that the development is done correctly and that the permitting and licensing is done correctly. And that, that involves identifying a suitable piece of land, engaging with the landowners, engaging with the local communities, starting an environmental impact process, applying to ESCOM for access to the national grid, and carrying out all of the different feasibility studies involved with that process to make sure that everybody that you are working with and around and the stakeholders that are involved in that project have a fair chance to raise any objections as you're developing the project. And that's basic development. It's very important that you consult with those that have either other rights or interested and affected parties in the process. And in South Africa, that process is quite robust. Most of that engagement actually happens through the environmental impact authorization, which is a very robust process and requires public participation and lots of engagement. And it's not just about the environment. It's also about communities. It's about economic factors. There are lots of different elements that come into that process. And so throughout the development of such a project, you know, a developer will be engaging lots of different parties. And in this particular instance, Renergen was one of the parties that we did engage. We engaged with them over a period of 2 years prior to the start of construction. There were more than 10 engagements with them, some of them in person, some of them through the environmental process, but some of them also just directly on a bilateral basis, where all of the information pertaining to the layout of the plant was provided to them, as it would have been in, you know, to all other parties as well. And participants in that process obviously have a chance to raise objections if they have an issue with the process. And a developer needs to take those objections into account and accommodate them. In this case, Renergen didn't raise any objections. There were no objections throughout that entire process until 7 months into the construction of the project, at which point they then claimed they had a large prejudice based on what we were doing on that particular site, which was very difficult for us, obviously, to accommodate at that time. So the normal development process is difficult. It's long, it's onerous, and it's arduous. But the process does make provision for proper consultation with interested and affected parties. And if that process is followed properly, and those parties also raise their objections when the opportunities are there, the development process can be successful, as it has been in all of our other projects. And we've developed, as I said, over 100 projects, also large scale projects, which in some cases also exist on pieces of land that have conflicting rights. But through the consultation process, one is able to establish how to accommodate those rights and make sure that the developments are sustainable and successful. These are issues which we face on a day-to-day basis. We're developing projects all the time. We're engaging with people all the time, and you know, some of the most of the concerns are of course taken into account and accommodated. But you know, if in this case the concern has come very late in the process, it's obviously very difficult to accommodate it because 70% of the plant is already constructed. The plant is actually almost up and running at the moment.
You know, I grew up on a giant sugar farm, a sugar estate, and I'd like to believe that I have a fair understanding of how hectares work. 400 hectares is a lot of land. Depending on how the land is apportioned or is actually cut up, you could have a piece of land that is at least 4 kilometers on one side. If my maths serves me, or what you call this, correctly. So this is by no means a small project. This is huge. You know, like what you're saying. And I'm just going to ask the question that I'm sure everyone would be keen to, you know and understand is, why wait so long to make that type of dispute for something that is so large. Because when it comes to large infrastructure projects, like you said, there's so many consultation processes along the way that even if you raise something at the very beginning, you probably would have to iron that out at that stage before you even reach the construction stage. And I guess for me, the bigger picture is, I guess, understanding that putting down projects like this is just no easy feat, and it sort of lets us know, you know, some of the hindrances economically that South Africa is kind of dealing with sometimes.
Mm-hmm. No, it's interesting that you make that point, and you're right. These projects are complicated and difficult. Many of them are under development, and they don't actually reach financial close. So there are lots of examples of projects that have been under development for many years, and they never get to the point where they're actually under construction. And that moment of reaching what we call financial close on such a project of this nature, which involves, you know, several billions of rands of capital investment that need to flow into the construction, requires all of the details of every permit, license, design, financing agreement, legal agreement to be exactly right at the time of financial close, and for all those economics to make sense for all the parties involved to allow that money to flow. And that's actually a very difficult thing to achieve. It's a very hard thing to achieve to get that right. It requires, at that moment of financial close, there's probably about between 40 and 80 professional people in the bank or in the lawyer's offices that are bringing that project to closure at that point. So when these projects enter into construction, that's already a very big achievement. It's a significant milestone to get to that point, to get them under construction. And so, you know, I think as a country and as a community, we need to take cognizance of the fact that when these projects reach that point and they've gone through all of those processes, they also need to be looked after. This particular project is creating 400 jobs for the local community. It's investing. It's already invested more than 140 million rand in local contracts. So local suppliers from the local area where it's being built are helping build the project. And it has an ongoing commitment to put money back into the local community. Over the life of the project, there'll be over 500 million rand invested into the local community just in terms of initiatives to support that local community, which otherwise is in these outlying places where these projects are built. Those communities are usually in a very destitute situation. So this is a real lifeline for these communities. And so when a situation arises like this, where there's now a challenge at this late stage in the project, which if the particular permit that Renergen is trying to challenge is overturned and the project is stopped, all of those benefits will cease to flow to the community. And also the clean energy that this project is going to develop will not flow, which is obviously a much wider impact in terms of our country. We are one of the per capita and per unit of GDP. South Africa is one of the worst, if not the worst, emitter of carbon dioxide in the world. So we have an extremely dirty electricity supply. And obviously, as you would have witnessed and your viewers would have witnessed throughout the last couple of years, climate change is having a real effect on communities. You know, these storms that we see in KwaZulu-Natal and in the Western Cape, these are the effects of climate change, and they have massive effects on these communities. So part of our obligation as a people, as humanity at the moment, is to try and solve one of the most pressing issues that we face, which is climate change. And this project is projected to generate almost 500 million kilowatt hours of clean energy per year, which offsets around 300,000 tons of CO2 every single year. And that's, I mean, to put that into some context, over our portfolio of solar projects, which is generating around 1.5 billion kilowatt hours per year, if you add up the amount of CO2 that's being offset from those projects over the life of their operations, it's the equivalent of 4,500 Eiffel Towers worth of CO2. So we're talking about a huge environmental benefit that this project has, along with all the other benefits that I mentioned about the community. And we don't, no one wants that to stop. No one would want that to stop, in the position that this project is in at the moment. So, you know, hopefully that gives some sense of the magnitude of where we are with this project, and also the difficulties of developing them.
All right. What I want to do now, Chris, is maybe zoom out a bit. I'm actually glad that I'm talking to someone like you who's putting down some of these large solar projects, because when it comes to my early example of having grown up on a sugar estate, right? You have a sugar estate, there's a mill, and you sort of build like a town, you know, or a community around that, where the main economic activity, you know, in that area, you know, has to do with sugar, the mill, and, you know, anything associated with that. And we see that with mining towns as well, and, you know, a number of other types of businesses. In the paradigm of coal-fired power stations and Eskom, right, we see, you know, something similar, that you have these, I can't remember the exact number, I think they're 23 or something like that, the power stations around the country that Eskom has. And you also see those as being, you know, little economies, you know, upon themselves. You have the economy that's built around the building, and then the economy that's built around, from production of power going onwards, you know, that in perpetuity as you produce electricity out of those. When it comes to some of these solar projects, people have, you know, different words, solar farms and all that. What do we expect, or what have we seen as being the result of putting down some of those projects? Because you have that initial wave of economic activity when you build, the project, which in the case of the Springbok project is where you guys are now. But once it's fully commissioned and it's now producing power and it's now going onto the grid, do we tend to see that type of activity happening, where you create like a small little economy around, you know, that, you know, solar project? How have renewable projects, you know, developed over time, and how do they, you know, go about, you know, the areas and the communities that they're in?
No, good question. So historically, as part of the government procurement program, which is commonly known as REAP, there were some obligations put on preferred bidders to be investing some of the proceeds of the projects into the local community, and to be operating different initiatives to support the local communities. We are operating our business, and this particular project is not part of the REAP program. So we are selling our energy directly to private customers, using the Eskom network to deliver that power, and we pay Eskom to help us deliver that energy. And whilst there are no specific obligations in what we must do with the local community, solar's development mentality is very much about making sure that the local community feels ownership in the project. And so what you talked about in terms of having an ongoing engagement with the local community and creating a small economy around the project is very important for us. And the amounts that I mentioned that we are investing back into the community, 10 million rand has already been invested and will be for the remainder of the construction project, as well as this 500 million rand over the life of the project. Those are initiatives that we have come up with and priced that into our offer to our different customers, to ensure that the community feels like this project is of benefit to them. And there's a very similar economy that develops around the project that you would find with a power plant. Obviously, the construction period, similar to a coal-fired power plant, there's much more activity during the construction phase. But in the operation phase of these projects, we still have to employ lots of people. In this particular project, there will be upwards of 40 or 50 permanent people that will be employed to operate the project. There are many moving parts that are going on. As I mentioned, the trackers are moving from east to west, so there are lots of rows of panels and several hundred thousands, almost 300,000 panels that are sitting on these rows need to be cleaned regularly as well. So there's a cleaning regime that goes on throughout the year. And then there's also security of the site and the perimeter, which is actually quite a big job, because you've got a lot of area to cover and to secure. So those are the three main job intensive factors. But there's also engineering things like tracking the plant, making sure that the energy is actually flowing. There's regular routine maintenance on some of the more technical electrical parts, like the transformers and the inverters. And so all of that creates, as you mentioned, a local economy around this plant in a very similar way that it would do for a coal-fired plant. And these communities have also not had the benefit of this kind of activity in the past. So they're very much in need of these opportunities in the areas that they're in.
All right. And the other curiosity, I like, the description that you give, because at least we can see how some of these economies can develop around some of these projects. I think that's the nice thing about infrastructure development projects, that the multiplier is often a good one, because there's so much activity that emanates from it. And, it tends to be on an ongoing basis, as opposed to something where once it's closed off, then it's done and people have to, sort of go off and find something else to do. So one of the other things that I wonder about, we once had a professor, on this platform, who was an energy expert, and we asked him this was some time back. And the question was about this was before Eskom had been split into the three different, companies, and they were still debating that particular process. And my question at the time was, over time, how are we going to see the proliferation, of solar plants and solar projects? Obviously, Springbok projects that you are describing is a large one, right? But over time, do we end up having a series of these large projects dotted around the country? Or do we have a series of the large projects complemented by maybe smaller ones that are more, maybe closer to towns, more closer to certain communities, estates, that type of thing? How do you see, for lack of a better word, the spatial planning of solar projects developing over time?
Yeah, it's a very good question. I think one of the things to remember when answering that question is that South Africa actually has a very well-established national grid. And that's not necessarily the case in many other developing countries. The reach of the national grid is not only quite significant, but it also is it's able to carry quite a lot of power around the country. So solar is an interesting technology because it's very versatile. It can be used on your house where you're not connected to a network whatsoever. It can be used out in the in the desert on a large scale. It can be put on satellites and launched into space. So there's a lot of versatility. But obviously, what one has to look at is what is the most efficient way of capturing the energy that's coming from the sun. And you must also remember that actually all of the energy on planet Earth originates from the sun. So the sun is sending the energy on an ongoing basis. And over the billions of years that it's been shining on the Earth, it has created a lot of the matter, that the organic matter that is eventually sunk into the ground. And that's what we pull out of the ground to burn to create energy from fossil fuels. But it all actually originates from the sun. And so what the question that we need to ask ourselves is, what is the most optimal way to catch that energy? And what is the most optimal way then to store it and distribute it so that it can be used by all of the people and industries that need it? And that is where South Africa is in a very interesting position, because we have one of the highest solar radiation resource areas on the planet in the northern part of our country, the Northern Cape area. And so ideally, what we would want to do is we would want to take up some of the space that's available in the Northern Cape. And there is a lot of space available. There's much more space available on unused land than there is to generate all of the requirements that we have. So we could take up just a portion of the unused land in the Northern Cape, and provided we could connect that at a high enough power rating into the national network, we could distribute all of the clean energy that we need on a very cost-effective basis to all of the members of our community. And that's where the other element of our business is very important, and that is the storage element. And so, you know, we operate a number of battery storage projects where we take the solar energy, we store it inside batteries, and we then make it available at the right time of the day or night. And the costs of those battery storage solutions have also, similar to how solar tracked down over the last 70 years since it was invented, those battery products have also become more cost effective over time as they've been used in the electrification of vehicles. And so the combination of the solar and the battery storage provides us with an ideal solution where you've got clean energy, which is being harnessed from the very source of all the energy that's coming to the planet, and stored in a cost-effective way and distributed around the country to everyone that needs it. And that, to me, would be an ideal solution. Obviously, we don't have the capacity at the moment to export that power from the Northern Cape, and that is why the projects are being developed in various other areas of the country to accommodate where the connections and where the power export capacity is most suitable. But there's also a lot of emphasis from the state transmission company, the National Transmission Company of South Africa, as well as the government. So you would have heard a lot of talk about improving our grid infrastructure. And a lot of that is to try and channel the grid into the areas where we have the best resources so that we can export that and use it.
Yeah, no, it's going to be an interesting one, you know, to watch over time how that develops, especially now that power wheeling has been made a little bit more appealing to people, and there are a lot more companies that are now investing in these types of, you know, these types of projects. I remember a few months back, we spoke to the guys at Teraco, who are a data center provider, and they, you know, have commissioned a 2 billion rand facility for solar, and then that's going to be, you know, wheeling power onto the grid and then, you know, providing for some of their other operations in other parts of the country. So it would be very interesting to see how all of those different components come together and, you know, over time, changing the overall energy mix, you know, of the country. But before we let you go, Chris, we are a financial platform, and you know, it's always great to hear about the funding aspects for these projects. Earlier on, you mentioned the fact that as Solar Group, you've helped to raise, you know, over 10 billion rand for some of these projects. I'm keen to get your sense of, you know, having been in business in the business for some time, around how attitudes towards funding these types of projects have perhaps, you know, evolved, you know, over time, because I can imagine that once upon a time when it was still more expensive, perhaps it was more unattractive, maybe it was an unproven, maybe people were still waiting for, you know, some of those proof points to be a little bit more material. Yeah, maybe you could just talk to us around what it's like funding infrastructure projects in 2024 versus a couple of years ago.
Yeah, I think in general, there's still a very positive appetite to be funding renewable projects. They tick a number of boxes in terms of, you know, being good for the planet, good for the environment, good for the communities, and also good for the customers, because we're selling energy to our customers at less than what they can buy from other sources like Eskom or the municipalities. And so it really is a very attractive business model. I think some of the concerns with financing projects have changed over time. Previously, I think there was much more emphasis on making sure that there was an end user that had committed to all of the power that a particular facility could generate. So the original instigation of these large infrastructure projects in South Africa was linked to a government program where Eskom was the off-taker and the state provided guarantees behind the power purchase agreement that Eskom signed to give the funders security that there would be a constant cash flow to service their loans and their obligations. That has evolved over time. to where funders have taken more of a view that the you know that there's a demand for electricity. You know, they're willing to look at some of the cash flows that might not yet be contracted at the start of a project, but could be reasonably expected to happen just given the supply and the demand of electricity in the future. And then other areas which I think are important to highlight are things like risks during construction, because at the moment in South Africa, constructing in anywhere is actually a difficult process. I mean, you would have obviously heard lots of stories around the construction mafia and various contractors that can be held up because you know, different elements of the community or the industry hold them to ransom. And that is a major risk. I think, you know, constructing projects here is a difficult thing to do. And I think funders are concerned about the delays that might happen, the effects on the local community, and the price variation that might happen as you're constructing projects. I think there's also a concern around how Eskom treats these projects and treats the industry going forward. There's a fair bit of risk taken in building these projects in trying to predict how Eskom is going to treat private IPPs in the future. And although there are various agreements and contracts in place, Eskom is obviously an entity that's very large. It's sort of the elephant in the room, so to speak, in the energy sector. And if it makes big changes and asks for things that might jeopardize these projects, that puts the financing into question. And there's an application going on with NERSA where Eskom are trying to restructure their tariff. And that actually has quite a major effect on the rollout of further independent power producing projects. So that is an example where, you know, the risks are like, but generally there is a good appetite. People want to fund these projects. And I think it's still a positive growing industry in South Africa, which is very, very positive.
Right. That's where we wrap up today's discussion, just understanding a little bit of what's going on in the world of solar in South Africa. Always great, you know, just catching up with professionals from that particular sector to understand some of the developments that are going on. Specifically today, we're talking about the Springbok project, which is a project that Solar Group, is involved in. Chris just giving us a sense of, what's actually going to happen there. It's a 195 megawatt solar project, and a lot of that is going to provide clean energy, and just getting a sense of some of the realities and some of the let's call them fights and disputes that actually happen in the sector, especially when you're undertaking such large infrastructure projects, some of the realities, and then also understanding what it actually takes to get these projects, just even to get them to the construction stage. We also took some time just looking, bigger picture to say what is, over time, where do we see the place, of solar in terms of, economic activity. And Chris just giving us some insight into, the type of economic activity that goes into building projects, and then once commissioned, actually running those projects, and also efforts to invest in communities so that there's a sense of ownership, and also at the same time, there is a sense of development in the areas that these projects actually happen in, and then also getting into spatial planning around projects, and then some of the funding attitudes and how that type of thing has developed over time. And it is interesting to see that from a funding aspect, we've gone from a stage where you almost had to know exactly who's going to take up, all the energy that's going to be produced, similar to, constructing an apartment building and wanting to make sure that all the units have been sold, before actually giving the funding, to a place now where it's a little bit more open-ended, because as a country, we've reached that stage where you almost know that, the demand will be met, at one point or another. It will be sold onto the grid. There are now so many options that are available, and solar without going too far, has become a lot more mainstream and, you know, a lot more of a comfortable bet for the funders. So that's been it. We have been in conversation with Dr. Chris Hall. He is co-founder and executive director over at the Solar Group. Chris, thank you so much for being with us today.
Madiwa, thank you very much for having me and for your questions and showing interest in our company. I look forward to engaging with you in the future again. Thanks.
And that's been it for this edition of the Business Day Spotlight. Remember that you can find our latest podcast on Business Live. That's under the podcast Business Day Spotlight tab on Twitter with hashtag BD Spotlight. And remember that you can review and subscribe for free on iono.fm, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Pocket Casts, or wherever you choose to get your pods casted. I've been Mudiwa Gavaza of the Business Day and Financial Mail. And this has been another edition of the Business Day Spotlight, which is a multimedia live production. So from myself and the rest of the team, it is a good evening, good afternoon, and good morning.